So let everyone get seated here. Well, I want to thank everyone for coming. This is a fantastic turnout. I'm really excited that everyone's really interested in JavaScript, and I hope we can convince the people here at South by Southwest that there should be a lot more really technical sessions, because I think that'll make people... So we have an absurd amount of content to cover today. So just really quickly, I'm John Rezig. I'm the creator of jQuery. We have Andrew DuPont. He works on Prototype. We have Thomas Fuchs, the creator of Scriptaculous. We have Alex Russell, co-creator of Dojo, and Sam Stevenson, creator of Prototype. So we have a ton to cover. We just picked a number of topics that interested us in particular, and hopefully there will be a good coverage here for you as well. So I'm just going to go straight into it here. With Sam.
Go to the next slide. So, can you hear me?
No.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to start off by just illustrating how we create a class in Prototype, and I'll work you through the process of building a clock widget that updates the time. So it's a very simple example, but it shows off a lot of features of the language and some of the conventions we have in Prototype. So to start off, can you go back? That's great. All right, this is a simple class. We'll just call it clock. We have a constructor that creates an element. Next. And we're going to add some time formatting code to this class. So in the createElement method, we're going to display the time. We'll do that by instantiating a date object and calling the update method that Prototype adds to elements to replace its inner HTML. So we've got this element that we've created. Now we're setting its text. And then we can, down at the bottom, you'll see an insert statement. So we're going to instantiate this class, which will add an element property to an object. And then we can insert that into the DOM. All right, next slide. So now we're going to hook up a timer so that every 500 milliseconds, the time refreshes. So to do that, we're going to make a call to a create timer function in the constructor. And we'll add that function. What that does is calls window set interval, which is a basic JavaScript function. And we tell set interval to call a method on the class. And so we've extracted our time rendering function into a method on the class called update element. So we just moved it out of create element into its own method, so that we can call it from create element and from create timer. All right, next slide. So we're going to add some options to the class now. We already have it updating the time, just a few lines of code. But we're going to let people change the color of the text in the class, in the clock, and change the format. So to do that, we're going to add an options argument to the constructor. And then we're going to merge it into the class with a function that Prototype gives you called object.extend. And this simply copies properties from an object into another object. So we're going to pull in the options into the class, into the instance of the class. And we're going to move the time format into a string template. So we've got this format thing up at the top, and you'll see we've broken that out into a string that you can now customize. And we've extracted a getTime function that returns a hash of the hour, minute, and second strings. So instead of building up the string directly, we're returning an object that we can pass into our string interpolation function. Then we're going to add a call to setStyle in create element to set the color. And so now we can set the defaults as properties right on the class as prototype. And then when we call object.extend, all these things get copied on top of the defaults. So we have these default settings, and we can override them either by subclassing this class or by passing in with options. There we go. Now we can see how we can pass options into this class. All right, next slide. One thing that's really ugly about what we had before is we had to call .element every time we wanted to insert, every time we instantiated a clock and then wanted to insert it into the DOM. So one thing Prototype provides for you is a method called toElement, or rather it doesn't provide it for you, but it allows you to implement this method in your own objects. And then all of the DOM helpers will call this method if it exists. So now we can just say, we can define toElement to return the element of the class, and then all the DOM helpers will automatically pull that in. So we can call insert or replace or update, which are the three main DOM helpers Prototype gives you. So that's an example of using conventions to clean up your code. And now I'm going to show you how we can add or modify existing behavior to classes. So this is an example of subclassing the clock class to change its behavior. And what we're doing here is turning it into a 12-hour clock. So we're creating a new class, subclassing clock. We're overriding the default format to add an AM and PM indicator. And we're modifying getTime to first call its superclass method. In Prototype, we do that by calling $super. We call $super. We check to see the hour of the returned object. This is a superclass method call. And we adjust the time, we adjust the hour accordingly, or set AM or PM accordingly, and then return that object, and then it's pulled right into the format. A different way we can do it is by quote-unquote monkey patching the code. And it's not really suitable for this particular example, but there's many cases where you don't have something already set up as a class. You have like a third-party library, and you can monkey patch this code so that you can make changes to the way it behaves, and you don't have to modify its source code directly. You can keep your own changes in a separate file. So this is an example of how you might do that. We use Prototype's wrap method that's available on all functions. And wrap allows you to keep a reference to the old version of getTime. So we're calling it original here. It's passed as a first argument. And then it's basically simple aspect-oriented programming. And this is how $super is implemented in the previous slide. So quick whirlwind overview of some stuff you can do with classes and Prototype.
All right, so I'm going to talk about browser sniffing, sort of a more abstract example than what Sam just talked about, and when it may be justified. There are going to be some people in the audience who may, in fact, scream out, "Never, ever justified, you Philistine!" And you know that I understand where you're coming from, but I'm going to draw a distinction here that may change your mind. This is my opinion. I don't speak for Prototype or the entire stage, certainly. But all major libraries do sniff in some places. You know, we've all got internal Boolean properties that we use for sniffing. So, I mean, you know, none of us can claim that we're absolutists against the practice. So, you know, there are some that will say that browser sniffing is universally evil. I submit that it's conditionally evil. If you feel like you've made a good faith effort to avoid browser sniffing, if you'd have to write 20 lines of feature detection in order to avoid one line of sniffing, then you shouldn't feel like a failure for sniffing. This is where I make a distinction between capabilities and quirks. Capabilities are things that Capabilities are things that some browsers can do and some can't, but that all browsers will eventually support. These might be emerging standards, APIs that one browser has introduced and, you know, will one day be a standard. Capabilities are optimistic. They're the things that we want to try before we settle for the standard path. Quirks, on the other hand, are a polite term for bugs. They're misimplemented standards. They're rendering bugs. They're any place that we have to handhold the browser. They're nearly always browser-specific. They're failures of the rendering engine or the scripting engine. They're pessimistic. They're the things that we bitch about having to deal with in the first place. So try a couple things before you resort to sniffing. The first, of course, is object detection. This is the easiest and most direct form of detection because you're testing for the presence of a function and therefore a feature. Here we're testing for document.evaluate, which is the function, which is a function given to us by DOM level 3 XPath. So this is how you would check for XPath. Object detection dovetails nicely with capability checks. The next is distilling to a Boolean. Performing some sort of test and then setting a true or false based on the result. You'd use this approach for capabilities that are more complex than the presence of a single function, but also for quirks that are easy enough to test for. This is a horribly contrived example, and in fact, I don't even know if that works, but you get the idea. You would fall back to sniffing whenever, for things that you can't test for programmatically, like opacity in this example, or for quirks that are prohibitively complicated to test for. The sky will not fall down. All the trains will continue to run on time. You might feel a little queasy, but frankly, you should be used to that feeling by now. So, you know, in short, try to do the right thing. You know, make a good faith effort to not to sniff, but at the end of the day, you have code to ship. Don't stand on principle. If you still don't feel right about it, think of it as an agreement between browser makers and web developers. If they act responsibly, so will we. We'll reserve browser sniffing for only the most heinous of bugs. And in turn, browsers won't have to keep adding to their user agent strings and imitating one another and thereby making it harder to sniff. So don't be afraid to sniff where you need to, but don't do it too often, or else browsers will build up immunities.
So that brings us to the next topic, which is quality assurance in the libraries. And as you can imagine, if we like change something in the libraries or add a new feature, no one wants to like go in and test this feature in each and every browser in different circumstances and so on and so forth. So what we do is we have tool chains that allow us to really easily go in and test if the libraries still work the way we want them to work. And we do this by writing tests. Go ahead. So this is an example how to not write tests or doing quality assurance. It's really bad. You should never ever have alerts in your production code for like errors and stuff. But as you can see, obviously they are around. So what we do is we write tests. This is a unit test from prototype. It tests the dollar function. As you can see, you have assertions which like make sure the function like returns certain results with certain inputs. It's pretty easy and straightforward. And you can like also use this stuff for your own JavaScript. All the different libraries have some sort of testing, unit tests. As I said, this is just an example from prototype. What does that mean for the libraries? This is the number of assertions for several different prototype versions. As you can see, the number of assertions in the unit tests for, in this case, the prototype library, like really, really grows and grows and grows. The number featured doesn't necessarily grow in the same progression, but as we hit bugs and have little changes, we certainly add assertions just to make sure that we don't like hit a bug again in the future. Okay. We also don't like to like call each browser individually and run through all the tests manually. So we in prototype we have a system that automates testing, which means I can just like go to the command line, and the system will automatically launch all the browsers I've installed, run all the tests in them, and just like gives me information if something doesn't work. In this case, the unit tests fail in Opera. I don't particularly use Opera, so I don't give a shit about it. But some people do, and we have some contributors that like fix these tests and go in.
So I should point out that of the most recent version, as of the most recent version of prototype, we do support Opera.
Yeah. Okay.
So quickly, when you are specifically tackling bugs, there's obviously a number of techniques that you could use to achieve that. At least in working on jQuery in my development process, I always try to localize a bug and reduce it to the simplest possible test case. I usually try to encourage people who submit bugs to do the same thing. And this is generally a good practice all around, and that find hopefully a single line of code that'll be able to cause the problem, and therefore you can easily figure out what the problem may be. So one thing that I also have is a test case generator. So it's just a little shell script, and I can give it the name of a bug, and I can give it the general problem area of the bug. So if it's within DOM, if it's within AJAX or whatever, and I can run this, and it builds out a copy of jQuery. It builds a couple possible test cases, and I can get running, and I can start fixing a bug within 1 minute. Which is incredibly useful. It was interesting because before this, fixing bugs was a hassle. But once I made this script, it became much, much easier and much more fun, if that's possible. And so, the last part, when you're doing, you're always going to have logging statements. Alerts can be especially tricky because if you ever get into a never-ending loop, it gets really bad. So you at the very least. Is spitting something out to an inner HTML, just sticking into a div or an ordered list can be incredibly useful.
All right, so next we're talking about event handlers. Every major library wraps around event observing. So as a result, we all end up keeping an internal store of handlers, of all the functions that have been assigned to elements. Some would store these handlers on the elements themselves, but that's a fast track to a common memory leak. It makes it very easy to create circular references between the function and the element itself. Instead, the best idea is to build a global hash table, and I'm throwing it right back to John.
So what this construct is that. Instead of attaching functions to the elements directly, which can cause these circular references in Internet Explorer, what you do is you attach, in our case, we attach a random property name, and we give each element a unique ID. And then using this ID, we can do a lookup into a giant data store. Well, not necessarily giant, but it'll just, just an object that stores all of these properties and all these functions. So what's nice about this is that it doesn't cause the explicit memory leak issues, and so that we can do our own cleanups here and keep things much tidier, at least in the memory.
So in many cases, Internet Explorer doesn't know how to garbage collect event handlers. This causes problems when the user moves to another page because all the handlers you attached, plus their corresponding DOM nodes, will remain in memory until the browser is closed. But it also causes problems when you remove elements from the page, either through you know, the DOM, either through the DOM methods, you know, remove child, or through changing the inner HTML of an element. When you, you know, when you, if you replace the inner HTML of an element that has a bunch of child nodes with just an empty string, then you've effectively removed all those child nodes from the document. Internet Explorer 6 is the worst offender here. Version 7 purports to fix the most heinous of memory leaks, but in truth, the fixes they apply are pretty blunt and really no better than what the libraries do themselves. I'm a bit more optimistic about version 8, but haven't done the testing yet. So let's walk through through one common leak that the current version of Prototype doesn't address. We'll be able to write about 10 lines of code to fix it until the next version of Prototype is released. Memory leaks are often so insidious that it's really of no use to look at your code and intuit that it has no leaks. You won't be able to prove it just by looking at it. You'll really have to verify it yourself by loading your page, sometimes reloading it over and over, and keeping a close eye on Explorer's memory usage. To make this easier, you can use a utility called Drip. We probably should have included the URL, but just Google it. Drip is a pretty obscure word. I'm sure you won't get any. Anyway, Drip is awesome. It's an IE view alongside a memory usage graph. To reproduce an exaggerated version of the leak, we can write a test page that will create, let's say, 10,000 elements, add an on-click handler to each one, and then remove the elements without removing those handlers. If we were to load this page in Drip, we'd notice that memory usage jumps up, and then when we refresh the page, it jumps up again, and so on. Memory usage increases with each page load. That's bad, and it's easy to spot in Drip. You can look for that stair step effect. You know, if memory usage increases on page load and then goes back down when you reload the page and then goes back up, then you're not accumulating memory over time. So that's not an actual leak. So to fix this, we can take advantage of, at least in Prototype, we can take advantage of a syntactic shortcut. Event.stopObserving is the function that removes a handler from an element. But if you omit the handler argument, it'll remove all handlers of a certain type. If you remove the type argument, it'll remove all handlers from the element, regardless if they're on click, on mouse over, etc. So we can write a function that selects all children of an element and calls event.stopObserving on each one with just the event argument, thereby removing all their handlers. And there's a second, I've included a second argument here called includeParent that, if true, will also remove handlers on the element itself that you passed in. So now we can use the wrap method that Sam talked about earlier to add some logic to Prototype's existing methods that involve removing elements. So this looks like a lot of code, but all it's doing is calling that event.purgeObservers function we defined for each of these methods, and then after that calling the original method, which in each of these cases I've named proceed. So we're wedging in this cleanup code at the beginning of each of these methods. The final line here, element.addMethods, is Prototype's way of re-adding these as instance methods on elements. So this is a drop-in fix for Prototype 1.6. We'll make these slides available so that you can grab this code later. It fixes only a very specific kind of leak, but every little bit helps.
Is this the most inefficient patch distribution system we've ever seen?
That was my goal.
I'm Alex. I work on Dojo. And so we kind of made an agreement to talk about things that are kind of common to all of the libraries, so I'm not going to stray too far from that path. And one of the problems that all of us run into when we're starting to construct larger applications is that once you've gone beyond a couple of custom scripts, once you're starting to build components that you want to reuse amongst a couple of pages, those components are going to have to start exposing some well-defined edges. And so Sam talked about classes and how you can build reusable components out of classes. But in a lot of cases, the API surface area for a class might be a lot more than you want to expose. And there are other cases where you don't know when an event or a cross-cutting concern is going to show up. And everything in your page is, generally speaking, event-based. I mean, JavaScript can be used in non-event-based ways, but the browser kind of backs us into a corner where everything we're doing is event-based. So if I know the things that are in the page, if I know all of the components that I'm looking at, I can easily say, I want this thing to connect to that thing over there. You can use Dojo's AOP mechanism, Prototype's AOP mechanism, those kinds of systems to connect two components that you can see. But what about when I don't know how many there are? What about when there's something that's coming off the wire? Like, I do some Ajax, I get a new component that shows up on my page. Like, maybe Rails is rendering a partial. I get a new component as a result. What then? So we all wind up in this situation where we don't know exactly what's on the page, but we all want them to do something in response to something else that happened on the page. So what do we do then? And the answer tends to be custom events. And so custom events are a way that we structure several components around to listen to a particular synthetic thing that we're inventing. So the DOM comes with a couple of nice styles of event, but it gives us no way to extend that model. Unfortunately, in the infinite wisdom of the W3C, they decided that they were good enough and we didn't need anything else. So all the libraries have to now make up for that. Can you go back one? The other thing to say is that you could obviously inherit. So like, let's say I've got a component on one page and I want to just do a subclass, right? That might be a quick way to get a customization of something that I want. In a lot of cases, though, subclassing is quickly a deep, dark rat hole that you're never going to crawl out of if you keep subclassing from one place to another, right? So what I want to do is I want to say, I want that behavior from that thing over there and that behavior from that thing over there, and I want them together, but the last thing I want to do is to create some intermediate class that I then have to inherit from. I mean, it's a freaking hairball, right? So we want to compose stuff, and one of the best ways to compose stuff is to build something that can listen to things from all over and then react. So that gets us into custom events. Custom events let us loosely join things. So here's an example of how the different toolkits might use custom events. Dojo, we have these publish and subscribe methods. They're basically a simple way of saying there's a topic, which is just a name you make up, and I'm going to send some event across it. And the signature is really pretty straightforward. I say, there's the name of the thing I want to subscribe, a particular handler to. It looks a lot like DOM, and I'm going to send some set of arguments to that function as an array. Prototype takes the event idea from DOM, and because it's got this idea of an element wrapper, which is useful in all kinds of places, you can start to expose custom elements as though they were DOM events. And so when Prototype's observe method shows up with a custom event type, it's going to pass along the default argument that you send along for the ride when you call the synthetic fire function on a particular node. But it all looks like it's happening through the node. So there's this nice encapsulation of how you can think about everything being a DOM element and extending DOM elements to get what you want. Whereas Dojo might say, you've got a bunch of JavaScript and then there's some DOM elements on the side and then you might want to make them play together potentially. Prototype kind of says, you've got stuff, it's all elements. And jQuery takes that to the next step, where everything is always an element. There's always something that's coming off of a jQuery result set. And so you do kind of almost everything by getting a list of nodes or things that look like nodes, binding events to them. Again, these can be synthetic things, and then saying, I want to trigger a custom event on it, which again allows you to pass in custom sets of arguments. But all of this is, these are just different syntactic styles for achieving the same thing, which is to loosely structure decoupled components in your page when you might not know what's there. So I can, in each of these systems, set up any number of subscribers to a particular thing and have something over on the side which doesn't know about any of them publishing data to all of those listeners. They don't have to know about each other. It's a really powerful technique, and it's something that we make extensive use of in the applications that we build. So the other, I'm really happy that John put this panel together because I haven't gotten to meet some of these guys before, and this is great. We all spend a lot of time learning from each other. That's the other big deep secret, if there is any. Like, we're all open source toolkits. Like, we don't have any secrets, really. I think we've all got open subversion trees. So
there are no secrets, sorry.
It's sad. You've been lied to. But one of the arms races that's been going on recently is with query selector speed. So I think Prototype had the first great widely spread implementation in their bling bling function for taking a CSS selector and passing you back a list of things that match it, which was great, right? Except it turned out to be a little bit slow, and so through iteration and evolution, everyone's kind of one-upped each other to the point where we now have, I think we're kind of at the edge of what you can do until the browsers give us something natively. And so there's a couple of basic strategies for doing this. And I don't really, you're not going to go write one of these selector engines, I hope, because trust me, it's not a lot of fun. You can ask any of us. But there's some trade-offs involved, and those trade-offs can help you understand a lot more about the environment that we're working in. Like, how we decided to make those trade-offs individually says a lot about the kinds of applications that we're building and the kinds of things that we think about when we're constructing libraries for everyone else to use. So the optimized DOM thing is where we all started. We all said, okay, there's these DOM methods. They allow us, we can convert a CSS selector into a set of DOM queries and go run it. It could be slow, it could be fast. It depends on how much caching we're doing. It depends on how much winnowing we're doing of the result set, how much basic memory versus space trade-offs we're doing. And then at some point, I think it was Joe Hewitt, Joe Hewitt's XPath, CSS to XPath converter kind of sparked a light bulb, and we started playing with XPath. Some browsers, some good browsers like Mozilla, support XPath over the HTML DOM, so you don't have to actually have an XML document to run XPath over the HTML DOM. That's pretty good, and this is native, so it's pretty fast. So we can convert CSS to XPath. So now we've got two systems where we can take some CSS selector, which we all know how to write. It's nice, it's beautiful, we use it all the time. And we have to create two different kinds of internal representations of that CSS selector to get to what we want. And now in comes, now that we've all spent significant fractions of our lives building and perfecting and optimizing these beautiful systems, in comes the cavalry, and the browsers are starting to give us a native version of all of this. It's called Query Selector All. The DOM API's working group finally got off their butt and did something, and now I think it's WebKit first, and now IE8 is going to have this natively. We're still waiting on Firefox. can you go to the next slide?
Firefox does at least have XPath, so there's
Firefox has XPath, so Firefox is way ahead in that. So but that comes down to these sets of trade-offs, right? So it's size versus speed versus complexity, and you have to make your choices. You don't really get any free passes here. Because what we're all, our biggest constraint in all of these libraries is the amount of code that we're sending on the wire and the number of requests that we're sending. And I think we're going to talk a lot more about that in a bit with regards to performance and packaging. But long story short, when you just ship one of these engines, like, the DOM is everywhere, so the simplest thing to do is to just build one of these CSS engines on the DOM, and that gives you all kinds of extensibility and power, and it lets people plug new selector engines in, and it allows you to handle all kinds of funky syntax and extend it naturally, but it might be slower, right? You don't have the ability to then leverage what comes natively down the path, because you've extended the syntax, and if the browser takes that away from you, it's kind of like writing a law, right? If all the states come up with their own separate thing, and they're all really great, they've all got their own little tweak, and then the federal government comes in and says, it shall be thus, and everyone has to give up their state-level law, you lose something in that deal, right? You lose something. And so you might lose extensibility, but you'll get performance, right? You'll get efficiency out of it, out of the system. The other trade-off is complexity. So for Dojo, we've got all three methods built in. That gives us the ability to be the fastest on basically any test at all, but it also makes our engine larger, right, in terms of code size. It also has a maintainability burden. I don't know of anyone else in the project who is actually willing to wade into that code besides me at this point. Which is really problematic. Whereas if you look at the jQuery engine, you've got people writing plugins to extend the selector syntax left and right, doing all kinds of awesome and crazy things just by being able to write a simple plugin. And so there's that trade-off between the community artifact of extensibility, the size and the wire, and the forward-looking cost. So people have written all these awesome extensions to the jQuery engine. What are they going to do when Query Selector All shows up and takes it away from us, right? So we said up front, we think we're going to have the straitjacket later. You can't have that fun extension syntax. I mean, people kind of, sad. it'll be good later, I promise. But that's a community discussion, right? And so this is just one discussion about how the JavaScript libraries wind up making these trade-offs. There's all kinds of other ones. When we get into component frameworks, UI frameworks, all those kinds of things, we're all making all of these same sets of decisions and trade-offs all the time, and you're going to have to as well. And I think the big thing that we've all learned is to kind of keep our eyes on the prize. What are you going after? For Dojo, it was we wanted an even performance envelope. For jQuery, I assume it's easy extension and relatively good performance and size on the wire. Prototype is great performance and good extensibility, and we've lopped off the extensibility end to get there. So, you know, to take the good with the bad.
So really quickly, I wanted to talk about how you get the computed style of an element. This is a very common problem that you want to determine, let's say, you know, the font size of an element or its position. And but the problem is that the way in which you do that, the browser has a special mechanism to tell you where it currently is, currently referred to as the computed style. And as with most things, there's an IE way, and then there's everyone else's way. But this is a case where the line isn't very, it isn't, you know, black and white, and that there are two very different ways, and one may not be as right as the other, in my opinion. So what happens is that Internet Explorer returns the actual value for an element, and just as an example, and whereas everyone else returns a pixel value. So, for example, if you have something with a font size of 2M, Internet Explorer will return 2M. And if you manipulate it via JavaScript at some point to turn it to 3M, it'll say 3M. Whereas all other browsers will say 24 or whatever, however number of pixels it is that represents 2M. So that's both good and bad, and that you have to realize that there's that significant difference there. So the issue is that you need to convert it to a common base. And there's this great piece of code here by this hacker, Dean Edwards. So we include this in jQuery. And what this allows us to do is to easily convert from the different types of units, like, you know, m's, percentage, and points, and convert it to a pixel value. So that way, in our computed style methods, we're always returning pixels. It's a trade-off we have to make, and that, you know, we don't get the benefit of being able to tell you what it is in M's in all browsers, but we just work to a common base.
This is another one of the non-secrets of JavaScript libraries. We all steal from Dean Edwards. We do so openly. This is... Nuggets, like little nuggets like this, I mean, in this example, if you'll notice, he left this in a comment on someone else's blog.
We all owe Dean beer.
And then at the same time, there's also this whole weird area with Safari, Safari 2 and 3, in which, so another thing that you typically want to do is get the computed style of an element, and you don't care if it's actually visible or not. But the one problem is that Safari, if an element is displayed on, if it's invisible, you can no longer get the computed style of it for whatever reason. I assume they're doing it for performance gains. But the problem is that people actually want to do this. It's a useful feature. And so Safari 2, was a common problem for a while, in that if you did get computed style, it would return undefined, and you would just have to find some other way around it. And then in Safari 3, it got much, much harder, actually. What they did is they now mimic like it's actually working, but it's not working. And so they return objects that seem to work, but instead they always return empty strings. And the problem is, though, is that empty string is an actual valid computed style. So you can no longer determine if what they're giving you is a lie or the truth. And so we have this code in jQuery now where, since all elements have a color, some color, even iframes, it'll have a color. So now if it doesn't have a color, we know it's lying to us. And so in that case, the workaround now is to make it to remove the display none, or if a parent has the display none, to go up and remove it, and then hopefully we will be able to get the style.
Here we're getting back to assuming good faith, and and, you know, when it's okay to sniff, in my opinion. But so with all that in mind, we come to how to find the dimensions of an element, which is a lot more complicated than you'd expect. First of all, which dimensions do you want? You know, the CSS box model, you could draw a number of arbitrary lines and call that the width. Do you want the width of the content? Do you want the width of the box, including the border? Do you want the width of the box, including the margin? Sadly, you know, we get some of these values through through the old DHTML properties introduced by IE, but they don't. These don't address our most common needs. We've got client width and offset width, and those are the bottom two in this diagram. What you most often want, what I find I most often need is the actual CSS width. But that's something that the DHTML properties don't give us. To get the true width, one approach is to get the offset width, which is the most reliably available of the DHTML properties on an element, and then subtract the stuff we don't want using computed styles. Padding and border on both sides. Find the computed styles of those. This is insane. We know. We can get the computed CSS styles for these properties. All browsers reliably report them, nearly always in pixel values. For instances where they're not pixel values, we have the magic of Dean Edwards reported earlier. And then, unfortunately, they're returned as strings, but we can parse them into integers before we do the math. So here's some quick. It's very nearly pseudocode, but this is prototype specific. You would use parse float instead of parse int because, as John recently found out on his blog, you can have half a pixel in Mozilla, which I don't know. but this
dude, I use that.
It's the same. It's the same idea for height as it is for width.
So let's take all of this and what does it mean for the progression over time of libraries of the features? As we've seen. The libraries influence each other, and new features come up and get optimized. And libraries start someone comes up with something, and all the libraries have it after a certain amount of time, the custom events. And it's a good example of how code evolves over time, and why we do stuff like we do it. So. That's old school effects. Does anyone remember these little scripts that change the background color of a page from black to red or whatever you had? That's worked like that. That's the basic effects engine. It's very basic. Then we got around to do something like this. It's frame based. It has certain points in time. The browser performance doesn't matter anymore. It just shifts out as many frames per second as it can. And everyone is happy, and this works very well. It's based on a set interval call, that means we just try to update the page, 100 times per second, and maybe the browser can do it 50 times per second, and we're all fine. That's something I'm working on now, is Scriptaculous 2, and it has a new effects engine, and it uses the custom events. The custom events like fire, the effect heartbeat events fires 100 times per second, and the effects engine just piggybacks on that, listens to the event, and whenever this event comes through, the effects engine renders the current frame. What's nice about this is you can exchange the mechanism that raises the event in the first place. So you can have a debug engine that raises the event when you say press the cursor left and right key so you can step through effects and or other stuff. There's just no limit how you can extend stuff with this. So it's a good example of how one part in the library that's you might think it's unrelated might influence other parts, and we sometimes also just throw stuff away and code because we are programmers. So.
Really quickly, we're going to be opening up to Q&A here in just a minute. So if you have a question, please step up to the microphones and keep your questions short so we can get as many in as possible.
Okay. One important thing I want to talk about is the JavaScript deployment and the three easy ways to get your JavaScript up to speed. The first thing is have your HTTP header set correctly and make sure your JavaScript is cached on the client side to avoid content expiration. So the second most important thing, this is from NASA.gov. They're really, really loading in too many like discrete JavaScript files. It just doesn't work. So what you want to do is you want to concatenate your JavaScript files into one file, so you only have one HTTP request to the server, or maybe to like discrete sets of files that like encompass certain functionality of your site. This is another example from Dean Edwards. In this case, it's not so good. Mm-hmm. He uses his packer thing to pack JavaScript. In my opinion, you should never ever use a JavaScript packer because it really performs not in a very good way, especially if you target like devices. Like the iPhone isn't that fast. JavaScript on the iPhone isn't that fast. You don't want to have your JavaScript packed within JavaScript. There's another way to do that, which is called gzip, and that's just a little example. Gzip like provides for 4 to 5 times compression on JavaScript for the most part, so you really want to enable this on your server, and all browsers can handle gzip with no problem. So gzip, content expiration, and the concatenation, and then you have really, really fast JavaScript.
All right, so I think we started to see some questions coming in. So we had a little bit more to cover, but I don't think we'll have time. So I just want to get to the questions really quick, and then if we have a couple of seconds here at the end, the slides will be online. So worst case, you can read them there. So question.
Hi, Shimon Rura from babbledog.com. My question is about Comet, which is a way of getting live updates from a server. What do you guys see as the ideal future for Comet? You know, what do you see for integrating it into your libraries or developing new libraries, server and client side? And what are the obstacles that are preventing you from getting Comet working in as standardized a way as possible across as many browsers as possible?
I guess I'll take that one. So I work on Dojo. We have a Comet client in Dojo's DojoX area, which is our extensions repository. And we have a project at the Dojo Foundation called Comet-D, which is working on both a series of implementations on the server side and a protocol called Bayou. And the protocol is a JSON-based publish-subscribe event notification protocol. Think of it as like super stupid middleware that just talks to a browser. It's like last-mile solution for a browser. And the only reason we need to do that to go to the core of your question is that the browsers are enforcing this two connection limit to any particular originating server. So there's a whole series of hacks that we have to employ both to multiplex events to a particular server, which is why we have this publish subscribe model, and then to make sure that we can go across domains. So right now, the best that we can do is to use a client side browser specific set of hacks in order to get multiple windows to talk to each other. We can use DOM storage on Firefox and other browsers that support it. We can use essentially IPC over cookies on browsers that can't. Trust me, you don't want to see that code. You wouldn't believe the bandwidth we can get over cookies in a set timeout. But yeah, no, it's dirty, it's nasty, but we have to do it for now. And so the best case solution is that we're going to get, hopefully, support out of the browsers, either through XHR or some other mechanism. There's a service and events proposal at the WhatWG working group. But right now, I don't think that they're adequately addressing the question of multiple connections and how we're going to make sure that we don't lock up the browser for other kinds of communication to a particular originating server. At SitePen, we're working on trying to build a spec that's going to inform those discussions. But in my discussions with the browser vendors, they're receptive to it. The use case hasn't, I think, been clearly articulated to them, even if it's clear to us. And so I have hope. In the interim, we have Bayou, and there's lots of implementations. I know there's a project to implement it at jQuery.
I've heard rumors of one for EXT. Dojo has the reference implementation, and there's at least there's like 5 Java servers, 1 Python server, 1 Perl server. I've heard of an Erlang server. I know there's a guy working on a C server inside of Lighty. So yeah, it's coming. It's real close.
Thank you.
I have had to use Prototype in the past for a client. I work for Avenue A Razorfish. The client did not have the ability to gzip, and I had to find a way to pack Prototype because it's huge. Actually, I think that the client actually found the way because I was telling them it was just not working. There was nothing I could do, and I have looked on your site to try to find out a way, and the only information I find on your site is to gzip it. Well, it's not always something that you can do. I'm assuming the client, it's server limitation. So what would be your suggestion in those instances?
So we also have a piece of infrastructure inside of Dojo called ShrinkSafe, which isn't a packer. So I want to make a distinction between things that try to do compression, as in like actually trying to pack more bits into less space, and then stripping, which is taking comment, white space, that kind of stuff out. So I know that Prototype does get shrinked up under ShrinkSafe just fine. And so you should use something like that. The other thing to do is if they've got a separate subdomain and you can put static resources on that, obviously, you know, Avenue A, you handle lots of large sites, you already have static image servers. Try to do that and set the expires headers out forever, right? That's pretty much it. Just make sure you're not hitting those 304s for those requests, and if you're going to, make sure they're on a separate server, because there's no bit like the one you're not sending.
So part of your question was how do I do it, and the other part was why couldn't I find it on the Prototype site? It's no excuse to say that I know that we all of us wish that our documentation were better than it is. It's certainly not the most helpful thing in the world for me to tell you to use Google, because you shouldn't have to find some random blog post, something I wrote in this case, to find the answers to these questions.
Subscribe to his blog.
That's right. documentation is something that happens over time. The way that we feel out where we're lacking is for people to let us know, even if it's through personal email, if it's through the Prototype mailing list, get out there and say something, and we'll do our best to make that better.
Okay, add that to the website.
I'm writing it down.
And I've used jQuery as well, and I actually prefer jQuery over Prototype, mostly because of size.
Snap!
Ouch.
I don't know. Part of me dies every time I hear someone say that. I don't know about it.
I really like jQuery over Prototype.
I wanted to get your thoughts on testing. Unit testing seems great for libraries, that kind of thing, where you have a lot of function calls. I'm doing mostly DOM scripting, and Selenium works. I need something that's good for regression testing, kind of automated, and there's Selenium remote control, but it kind of seems... I wish there was some kind of middle ground between doing unit testing and Selenium-type testing. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Unit testing as a whole isn't... It isn't a terribly complex thing. The problem is that usually the unit testing frameworks become incredibly bloated. Just testing as a whole is nothing more than printing out some output and seeing if you get what you expect. So the code to write your own little thing would be 20 lines max in any framework, or even just hand coded. Even just printing out to a div, a pass, this was true, it would be more than sufficient. And I think that at least that would be, at least a middle ground between, something that's incredibly massive where you don't need something that complex.
Right.
Okay. See, the other side of it is that Selenium RC is a little bit of a Frankenstein, right? It was kind of glued together over time.
Yeah.
So with Dojo, we're playing with a tool called Windmill, which is out of OSAF, the Open Source Applications Foundation. it looks really promising. It doesn't solve all of these issues, but it does have drivers out to clusters. There's also now, I think OpenQA has done a clustered Selenium thing, which should let you kind of handle a bunch of browsers at once without having to have it on your box. You might be able to throw it out to a cluster and handle that.
Just a quick comment. Windmill is pretty neat. You can do all sorts of automating, like clicks and stuff, and it's all pure JavaScript.
Sweet.
So I think that Selenium and the unit tests like serve two different purposes. Like the Selenium is functional testing, mm-hmm. and the unit tests are unit testing. So it might be that like one tool is better suited for the job than the other. So maybe it's a good thing that it's separate. So right. Depends on your situation, of course.
Thanks.
Hi. Do any of you have plans to interoperate with Google's Caja sanitizer?
Yes. We're working very closely with the Caja team. So just to clarify, Google Caja is this sort of subset of JavaScript that's deemed to be kind of secure. And so essentially what you end up doing is you pipe JavaScript code through and you get an output that is you're able to run safely. And that's the crude explanation. But I think their goal is to be able to use it like in widgets and things. We're working very closely with them. We've been giving them lots of feedback, them to us. So yeah.
The prototype team. We have someone working on that for prototype as well.
Yeah. I'll try not to make this a pointed question, but can you guys talk a little bit about how your frameworks are doing AJAX accessibility and where some of the frameworks fall short? Like I said, not try to be pointed, but I know some of them are doing it better than others.
Oh shit!
So at least I know that it depends what you mean by AJAX accessibility. In the case where usually AJAX accessibility means that you're writing things in a particularly unobtrusive way, unless you mean accessibility in the screen reader sense. There's multiple scopes of accessibility. There's at least I see in that AJAX accessibility is in that you take a website that works without JavaScript, and then you layer on the JavaScript when you have a browser that supports what you're doing, and in that manner it degrades very gracefully. You can have people who don't support a certain feature set, the site will still continue to work for them. The other aspect is. The overwhelming accessibility. So in that the JavaScript works, but the person who's using the site is having difficulties with it, either visually impaired or what have you. And at least in that case, I know that Dojo and both Dojo and jQuery are putting a lot of effort into that.
I can speak to that a little bit. We kind of agreed not to talk about things that aren't in all the toolkits. Dojo does, I will note, though, have a full UI component framework. And when we hit that problem, I think it's not quite fair to ask at the kind of the like prototype.js or jQuery.js level, what are you going to do about accessibility? It's the browser's problem. But when you get into building your own components, you chew off all those responsibilities that the browser would have otherwise taken up with regards to providing hinting about low high contrast mode, keyboard handling, ARIA hinting. And so we've made a commitment inside of Dojo. So all the widgets in the Dojo digit area have a high contrast mode. They have full keyboard hinting. They are toggling ARIA roles and states. And we've been working closely with the with some of the folks at Mozilla and IBM to make sure that all works as well as it can. And we're tracking the next version of ARIA in the upcoming version of Dojo. So I think that's just... once you hit that level of sophistication with your component set, it's your responsibility. And so, there are toolkits that aren't doing it, but hopefully the work that we've been doing is, I think, shaming some of the other toolkits into getting there.
In terms of accessibility,
like the jQuery UI, we're working very closely with Mozilla, with the Mozilla Foundation as well, and getting full ARIA support. And so, yeah.
In terms of accessibility, as far as having JavaScript disabled, it's really not a JavaScript framework problem because you can't do anything if JavaScript's disabled. So it's more of an application and server-side issue, at least from my perspective. And things you can do to make that easier are use a framework like Rails, which lets you reuse the same URLs for different content types. So the same URL might point to a full HTML page, or it might point to a JavaScript response that gets evaluated automatically by an AJAX request. And you can also use things like event delegation, so that instead of installing inline event handlers, you can write code that monitors, for example, all clicks on a page, and then unobtrusively performs AJAX requests or what have you.
Can I disagree? Sure. So I think it's a question of what's least effort, right? So if I'm going to give someone a JavaScript way to do it, and I'm not going to give them a way that's as simple or simpler to do it with fallback so that it's easy. I mean, the Rails has a really great story here, but when you're just writing JavaScript and you're looking at some code that you're upgrading in the page, right? If it's easier to just do it in JavaScript and not have that fallback markup there, you can get yourself into a world of hurt. It's really a question of friction. No matter how much people care, they're only going to work so hard to get it. So, I mean, I think there is a responsibility for the toolkits there.
Super, super quick.
Just kind of appreciate the work you guys have put into the individual frameworks that you work on. And I wondered if you have any pointers for others working on frameworks of how to develop the sort of good-natured collegiality that you seem to have.
Come up, introduce yourself.
It's still a really small community, right? And like everyone who's a high-functioning JavaScript programmer essentially knows everybody else who's a high-functioning JavaScript programmer at this point. And I think we've all tried to keep it civil. There are people in some of our communities who have crossed that line, but I think all of us are committed to keeping it cordial and civil and, you know, collegial.
I know the last thing that I want is having language wars only their framework wars. I think that it's just the ultimate in futility.
We also like the turnout of the talk and that you haven't killed each other for now. Thanks.
Well, thank everyone for coming.